Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English debt.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is October the 12th, the Zwolf of 2019, you're welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. And somebody, being very prescient, has called that number and is waiting patiently, we hope, to be on the air. So, caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello. Hello, caller.
Nope.
Apparently, the caller decided to take his or her ear away from the phone.
Yes.
And put it someplace else. And the phone had the ear previously. Anyway, there's a lot of things going on.
We said we were going to talk some more this hour about something last hour.
Yeah, we're going to talk about an interesting thing that the Federal Reserve is doing that is not the Federal Reserve chairman said very distinctly was not quantitative easing, despite the fact that a decade ago it's exactly what quantitative easing was. In other words, the Federal Reserve is setting up a facility, a methodology, a procedure, and pumped on Friday alone $82 billion into the system. They're basically buying, instead of just short-term pumping money in, they are buying short-term treasuries. Why are they buying short-term treasuries? Because every time they buy a $1,000 or a $10,000 treasury bill, and they're only buying bills short-term, it puts $10,000 of dollars as opposed to treasury securities back into the system. And as a result, what had happened was it was over the last several weeks, initially they thought it was because of some unusual occurrence. It was a one-off kind of thing. It would never happen again, where suddenly there's a shortage of cash in the banking system. Short-term, now we're not talking about loans and treasuries and things like that. There's actually a shortage of cash in the banking system. And as a result, overnight loans jumped to 10% all of a sudden, 10% on an annualized basis, instead of being around 2%. And so the Fed jumped in and pumped some money into the system and went back down. And the next day they went up again. So they've had to do this every day now for about 2 weeks, and they finally concluded that there's something systemic going on. And now they're just setting up a steady buying program of short-term treasuries in order to keep enough cash in the system to keep the system working so that overnight loans could be made. Now, what does that mean? Why is this happening when it hasn't happened before? Actually, it happened a little bit in 2008 and 2009, but they were doing a lot of other buying at the same time, and it was kind of buried in the midst of all the other buying. Here's what I think is happening. This is Jeff speaking. The Treasury is borrowing. We hit $1 trillion in 11 months of Treasury borrowing this year. Now, technically, the deficit is not quite that high, but the Treasury had to replenish its reserves. So the Treasury has now borrowed over $1 trillion more than it took in 11 months, the fiscal year that ended in September. The fiscal year ends this month, the end of this month. But the first 11 months of the year, of the fiscal year, the Treasury of the United States borrowed $1.1 trillion more than it brought in. And because of official policies Secretary Mnuchin, Secretary of the Treasury, wanted to borrow long term. He wanted to go out to 30 years because interest rates are so low. This is such a deal.
Right.
Let's stretch this out as long as we can. And the president vetoed him very hard and said, no, keep it short term. And the reason he wants to keep it short term is he wants to keep the interest payments down. I personally think it's a really bad idea if you're going to borrow money. You don't intend to pay it back for a long time, if ever, to do it short term, but this is what they're doing. And these really short term interest rates being low makes it really easy until all of a sudden they aren't.
And they weren't for a while.
And the reason this is happening, I think, after doing a lot of research over the last couple of weeks, is simply that our deficit has finally gotten high enough that it's beginning to affect the rest of the economy. It's beginning in what this is the first sign. When we're borrowing short term and the Treasury is borrowing so much money that there's literally no cash left for anybody else to borrow.
Right.
And interest rates start up, then the Federal Reserve has to go in. Remember that the Treasury is selling Treasury notes. That's how they borrow money.
Right.
The Federal Reserve is now stepping in and buying the short-term treasury bills and treasury bills. They're selling treasury bills, buying treasury bills. So the Federal Reserve is now directly funding the deficit, which I felt like was going to happen at some point.
Yeah, it's kind of has to happen, or the money gets sucked out of the system. We would be It's not like people are not buying the debt. It's not like people aren't showing up and buying that stuff. It's just they're using up all the money that they would use for any loans that they would give to anyone else to do it with, which means that nobody else gets short-term loans unless the Federal Reserve steps in and buys up that stuff and puts cash back into the system.
So we literally have hit the point where the deficit was forcing out other loans, and that was been warned about for years and years and years, and there's not been a big deal made about it. But this is also probably why the president wants short-term interest rates to be kept low so that the interest on the federal debt stays low. But frankly, this is it's kind of like if your debt is going up and you're spending more money in your family than you're taking in, and it's getting worse and worse and worse each month, going and getting a bunch of credit cards and running up the bills on the credit cards is not a long-term solution to that problem.
Long-term solution is either raising revenue. That in this case would mean raising taxes. Nobody's really, really keen on that. Or cutting expenses. Well, this is a tough one because nobody's really keen on cutting expenses either. We've got to have some conversations about Medicare and about Social Security because we're running out of money there. And we're talking about now we're well within the decade mark. We're talking
2034.
Till it is upside down completely and they're cutting rates, but we're talking about well within the decade we need to have a solution within this decade or it's going to be really expensive.
Combination of interest and revenue to Social Security actually kept it in technically positive territory until this year. And it didn't make a big deal. It was no big thing. But a couple of months ago, the Social Security Trust Fund technically went negative in the sense that it's now having to say we're liquidating. Literally, they are selling these special treasury securities on the open market to liquidate them. These special treasury securities can't be transferred to somebody else, but they can liquidate them by saying, here, I've got this treasury security, give me cash for it. And they're able to do that. And for the first time, they're doing it. And again, this increases the borrowing on the open market. At some point, in my humble opinion, this is going to rear up and bite us, or we're going to have the Federal Reserve doing some tremendous amount of loaning money to the federal government.
Which is not a healthy situation.
We're entering uncharted territory with this deficit being as high as it is.
And nobody's talking about cutting back. I'm only hearing about
spending more.
Adding benefits. And not that I wish we could all get benefits as much as we wanted. I wish that were possible without, I wish that I could live in 9 houses worth $1 million apiece. I really don't. I think I like my own house the way it is. But that concept is there. The reason why we don't do that is because we can't afford it. Long term, the U.S. government has to come to some kind of a understanding with itself to say that too much debt is bad.
Actually, the American people have to come to that understanding because it's our government.
Yes,
and we voted in. We have opted, and in 2016, and again in 2018, we basically said we're going to elect a bunch of people who will spend a lot more money than they're taking in, and then accelerate the spending, and not raise our taxes. And we think that's cool for some reason. And
it feels good right now.
And John Carter's right in the middle of them. And I don't understand. I actually asked him that question once, and he decided not to answer. How is it that he was so against deficit spending when there was a Democrat in the White House, and he's so for deficit spending now? It's a little beyond my comprehension, but maybe somebody who knows him better can get a better answer out of him.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, I just think that the average American does not understand how much $1 trillion is. And I think maybe our politicians do not really understand how much $1 trillion is. I had a fellow explain it once. I heard him on some talk show. He said, if you stand by the window and you throw out a $1 bill every second, it'll take you 36,000 years to throw out $1 trillion. But people do not understand the word trillion. They don't know. They don't understand how much that is.
It's 1,000 billion.
Yeah, and I would say that not just the average person, but no one is capable of understanding what $1 trillion is.
It's 1,000 billion, and 1 billion is 1,000 million, and 1 million is 1,000 thousand.
Well, and when Bernie Sanders and those people talk about doing something that will only cost us $92 trillion, you know, that's not possible to ever pay back.
Wait a minute. You know? Hang on. Let me give a – I don't like Bernie Sanders, but let me give him a credit. He also wanted to raise taxes to cover it.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, I mean, if you're going to – now, this is my point. If you're going to – we have an administration and a Congress that just raised spending dramatically while cutting taxes. I don't agree with Elizabeth Warren. I don't agree with Bernie Sanders. But at least they say, here's the programs we want, and here's how and where we will raise taxes to cover it. Whereas, very frankly, the Republican position is we're going to spend a lot more money and we're going to cut taxes. And some part down the road, somebody will then have to pay that back.
Well, I'm just saying, where's the common sense in all this? If the people, we the people, don't understand how much $1 trillion is, and we don't understand that $1 trillion will be repaid by us, the taxpayer, then how can you agree with that kind of an idea?
I don't. Well, that's my point. Why do this is my position. Whoever's in power is the people I'm going to criticize, and the Republicans in Congress and a Republican president signed a bill. They created and signed a bill that raised the deficit to $1 trillion during good times. Why?
Let me hit this.
And they knew they were doing it.
We don't need to understand the word trillion. If you are running a lemonade stand and you make $3.33, but you spent $4.01 or $4.10 on lemons, did you do well?
No. You're going to go broke.
Well, the revenue to the government last year, 2018, was $3.33 trillion. And the expenditures last year was $4.1 trillion. See, you can take the word trillion away and just say you can't keep spending more than you make. That's the easy part. This is the common sense that we get confused as soon as the word trillion comes in. Just throw it out. If you make $3.33, you can't spend $4.10.
You can for a while. Because you can always borrow money from your parents.
Okay, and do people that don't own a lemonade stand and have never been self-employed, do they understand your analogy?
I think if they look at their debts on their credit cards and it goes up every month and it keeps going up every month.
I've got a good answer.
What's
if
that?
The answer's in the form of a question. How many times have they been bankrupt? Because if you say two or three times, I would say, no, they don't understand. If they say one time, well, maybe they understand after that first bankruptcy, they're in the clear now, and they understand you cannot spend more than you make repeatedly and come out of it smelling wonderfully. So that's the deal, is that our bankruptcy rate isn't that high in the United States. We understand this. This is why it is called common sense, because it's common. You can't spend more than you make repetitively for a long period of time and come out okay.
Well, wait a minute now. Wait a minute. That's not necessarily true.
Really?
How many times has President Trump had entities declare bankruptcy and he's come out a billionaire?
Well,
it worked. It worked for him.
Personally, he's never been bankrupt.
Yeah, but he's
got corporations that have been bankrupt.
Right.
So you can look at it both ways.
Yeah, but he came out a billionaire.
He did.
So it worked.
It's done very well for him. Yes.
It worked. He's a smart businessman.
How many of our senators and representatives have ever had a lemonade stand are been in business. That's another problem we're facing here is if they've never been in business and never owned a lemonade stand, they've never had to manage money.
You got a point there.
How can they manage our taxpayer money?
Well, I got to tell you, the reason why they haven't is because they're more into margaritas.
Well,
the other thing they use lemons in, or maybe beer.
I got to try to get in this back door, so I better turn you.
Okay,
right. Thanks for the call.
All right. You know, and it's not a political issue; it's a fiscal issue.
Fiscal set by politics, so anytime anybody speaks fiscally, people go, well, you must hate or love these politicians. And the reality is that we need a lot less crony partisan stuff. We need a lot more. This is if you have a semi-divorced couple that insists on doing all of their finances together, but they cannot sit down and have a financial conversation. You have a problem. That's the nightmare case for anybody giving advice. If they're very wealthy and they have a lot of debt and a lot of income, it gets really complicated. The bottom line here, the solution to it, is that both spouses have to sit down and have a common understanding of their goals and their methodologies. And that's what Congress and the president are supposed to be doing, and they're not.
I'd like to change the subject.
All right.
There's a major conundrum, and the Economist had an entire issue on it. And it is the world economy has changed, this new world economy, and it showed a Mobius strip of the world. Things are turned upside down and inside out. We used to be very reliably confident that when employment rates got low enough, inflation would go up. Federal Reserve would start to raise interest rates to head off inflation, and pretty soon unemployment would start to rise. We go through a mild recession, we come back out of again. It's not happening. Why is it not happening is one of the big questions, because something has changed fundamentally in the economic system of the world following the Great Recession, so that we have record low unemployment. And I mean record low. I realize technically in 1969 we had the same level of unemployment we have today, but in 1969 we had the draft, and we had literally hundreds of thousands of people drafted into the army that were employed. And
we also had a lot fewer women in the workforce.
Right. So we have this amazing low unemployment rate, this amazingly high employment rate in the United States. And at this point, traditionally, the competition for workers would cause people to start raising pay rates. Now, there's a lot of things have changed. This basically, you have to go back to the 1830s to find it. We've had a fundamental change in the economy. And it's important to realize that we shouldn't be trying to follow the rules of the old economy with the new one. People said we're in uncharted water. We're just not in very well-documented water because, again, back in the 1830s, the same thing happened. And it happened because of an advance in technology. We're getting advances in technology. It's happening again, advance in transportation and in automation technology. We've got a major change in the economy.
And let me give you a one-off example of that. Can you right now do a computer search for any electronic item? Anything? Yes, you can. You're capable of it. So we have...
What, do you hit the any key?
Yeah, the any key. Yeah. So say you want to look for a wireless router. So you would go Google, maybe Yahoo, maybe Bing. You might go to Amazon. How many of those are made in the United States? Ooh, yeah. Zero. None. Why? We invented all this stuff in there. Well, because it's cheaper to make it somewhere else. Okay, so we've moved our supply chain around. A lot of the companies that are selling them are American companies, and they're going to keep the profit from the manufacturing of that item, but it's not made here anymore. Okay, so we're fully employed, but a lot of what we make and a lot of our employment comes from manufacturing elsewhere. So when we got rid of the manufacturing jobs, and we've done that, we've put in Service and trade-oriented positions where people are on the phone to China or flying to China or Thailand or anywhere else, Mexico, where we've moved these manufacturing facilities. Vietnam, any of these places, you've got people that are in charge of tracking that at the employment level, and they're getting paid to do it. The profit to the company is still at the company so long as there is as the manufacturer isn't stealing investment intellectual property, and that's a real problem. So long as that's not happening, it works out well. But you just said something at the beginning of last hour. The CPI was released, and we had a net zero inflation because prices on stuff are down, but prices on services are up. So what we have is inflation on the service side, but the stuff side that we're not making here anymore, the prices are down.
Now, this is one of the critical points that's in the middle of all of this, that in this new economy, we have more supply than we have demand for products.
That's why the prices are so low.
And yet we just installed tariffs that lowered the supply, which means something moved in that equation.
At some point, things are going to be more expensive.
The supply side of things. In other words, the supply side of things hasn't shrunk, except it's shrunk a little bit, but it certainly hasn't grown. Now, if you have a more supply of something and the demand remains the same, the price goes down.
Right.
If you have the same supply or supply shrinks a little bit and the demand falls, then the price goes down. And since we know that the supply is not rising dramatically, it's staying pretty much the same, there is in that 0% inflation for goods, we're seeing that people are buying fewer. Somebody, somewhere, somehow is buying fewer goods.
Right.
Which means we've been coasting downhill all year. That's a signal that people and companies are approaching the end of their ability to buy, and they're not buying more stuff. They're buying the same stuff, or they're buying the same amount of stuff at this point. Which is, and I wouldn't be surprised to see if the demand side of things continues to shrink. And very simply, for the same reason I'm concerned about the deficit, people's credit cards are getting full.
Yeah.
And they're starting to back off. Now, the question, the biggest single question will be, how does the Christmas season look? If the Christmas season comes in like gangbusters and we get a big increase over last year, all is well, folks.
Yeah, we'll go for another quite a good number of months looking great.
If it turns out that the Christmas shopping season falls off from last year, fasten your seatbelts.
And that sounded very, very wise. I'm going to tell you all a secret. That's true any year. Doesn't matter the year.
Well, we've had a couple of stutters at various times,
right,
where the Christmas season fell off a little bit.
A little bit.
And it wasn't a big thing. This year, if it falls off a little bit,
it'll be a big deal.
Because
we're at a tipping point.
And the key thing to understand, we talked about this in the newsletter, and it's important to get it. The manufacturing, the two-thirds of economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal say that manufacturing is already in a recession.
Yeah.
All the indicators are that transportation is in a recession. Year over year, the use of railroad cars is down by 5.5%. That is not a growing economy. That's a shrinking economy.
No,
there's a lot of signals going on out there that I think we should pay attention to.
I'm going to throw some things in here that at first will sound contradictory to what you just said. Bear with me for a moment.
I'll be a bear for
okay.
a moment.
And then I want to wrap up kind of the end result of what we've just been talking about. So we're fully employed here. They're not fully employed in China yet. So it's still cheaper to manufacture in China even with tariffs. It's just getting more expensive here. We're manufacturing within a very, very close amount to the absolute record amount we've ever manufactured in the United States before. And it's been growing for a decade, far beyond what we've ever done before. We're down a little bit from the top. But if we compare what we did today to the heyday of the car manufacturing blitz in the 1970s, we're manufacturing about 2.5 times as much stuff in the United States but we're employing about 10% as many people doing it. So manufacturing is in a recession, and we've been cutting back on people there, and so how is that possible? Well, automation. Even in the 70s, we saw that coming. The big machines that were piston and steam driven that were figuring out how to put the bolts on the tires at the right spot. And we've got the tire getting put on there, and you put the lug nut on there, you're good. You got it on there, and the machine did it. And a person didn't have to do that with a tire iron. So come forward to today, where a lot of our manufacturing is being done overseas. We're manufacturing more of our items overseas than we are here. And yes, we're hiring other people to do it. It's still our property. So it's an American company that's invented it, sent it overseas to do it. We're manufacturing more here than we ever have before. And we're manufacturing more than that somewhere else for our own use. If we get a recession, we're not going to have as high a demand for that imported stuff. The prices will drop, and it probably will impact the rest of the world, which will cause us to bring more of that manufacturing back here. A moment ago, I was telling you about, you know, putting a manufacturing facility somewhere else, and we hired service people to fill that gap, to say, hey, we've got to keep watching this stuff. Those people lose their jobs when we bring that manufacturing back here and automate it. And we didn't add a whole bunch of jobs in the manufacturing world because it's automated. We'd be getting rid of service jobs to bring it back. And that's what's going to happen in the coming recession, whenever that happens. This is just the steps that have to be taken at corporate levels to say, if tariffs are there and could be there again. So let's say we get a trade deal. Let's give the glowing example.
Mm-hmm.
The president gets everything he wants. We get a deal on the books for everything we want. We got free trade. That will make a lot of the corporations feel better about things, but they've been burned. We had a trade deal coming up, that multiple of them, that we backed out of. We backed out of deals that another president signed that this new president backed out of. What if the next president does with this, whatever this wonderful new deal is, what if the next president backs out of that one? And so corporations are going to have an incentive, an extra scary stick incentive, not a carrot incentive, to say we need to leave this stuff here, but we can't afford American workers, so we're going to automate.
Yeah, that's
that's
clearly
the new
something.
Thing. The mm-hmm. supply lines that have been spread all over the world are forever going to be altered in the next recession. They're going to be brought back closer to the people that are using them. And the long term, and this is great, if you look up the term future meat, they're expecting to come to market in the United States in the year 2020, that's next year, with meat that is real meat derived from real animal, but grown in a lab rather than out on a farm.
Yep.
And their goal, Future Meat, isn't to sell the meat. It's to sell the manufacturing capability of the meat. Kind of like what Tyson does with chickens. Tyson slaughters the chickens, but it hires out the farming of that to lots and lots of farms out there. And they're one of the investors in Future Meat. So Future Meat wants to do essentially the same thing, but if you just kind of crank forward in time a little bit, follow the time horizon, if that becomes a more normal technology, more ubiquitous around everywhere, the price for that technology is dropping drastically now. They expect to be on par with beef prices when they come out with that grown. And that's fantastic, to say the least, as far as how they got the technology to work to do that. I don't know about the taste yet. I know there's a lot of things that are big questions out there, but this is a direction that technology is going in, the manufacturing of something close to where it's used. Because these facilities would be put together near metropolitan areas so that the grocery stores would have it very quickly. And eventually, it might be something that you just have as a part of your house. You just go in and pour the nutrient into your meat grower, and it prints out perfect steaks for you. That's cool. That's a thought that goes way out. But what's just happened to all the supply chain? Now you've just got some nutrients that you put in there and maybe some repairs that have to be done on the manufactured items. And at some point, you may actually be printing out the parts that you need to replace the parts that broke. That's the concept, is that the supply chain is about to get a lot shorter in the next decade. We've spent the last two decades making our supply chains longer and longer and longer and working really hard and keeping the prices down on that pretty well inefficient system. And if you think about, say you want to buy a flat screen, as if there's any other form of screen really available these days, you want to buy a screen for your monitor or for your television, and you go online and you buy it, and you look at the price, and the price is far lower than what it was 10 years ago for the same size anything, and a lot lighter. It's a technological increase. This is amazing. Prices are lower. Where did that thing come from? That's including the shipping cost from the other side of the Pacific in a very large ship that may have taken weeks and months to get here. If we could do that in an automated fashion here, we can lower the price almost immediately. And that's what's coming. It's just going to take a big financial shock for us to bite the bullet on the front end of that investment to build the facilities here to do it. But don't expect manufacturing jobs to suddenly come back. That's a thing of the past. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. How is this supposed to affect our cattle industry? And also, how is Europe reacting to this new Soylent Green type meat?
It's people! No, I'm sorry. I couldn't pass that up. I had to throw that in there.
The Europeans will probably, excuse me, bite off on it.
Yeah.
Because if they look at it and say, and they conclude that it is environmentally sound and it doesn't have any bad chemicals in it and there was no genetic modification, what is it going to do to the cattle industry? I'm going to tell you, it's not
going to be pleasant. It's very much, this is something historically, the corn hog cycle was something that lasted and was measured a very long time. And it was very reliable as a pricing cycle until the railroads brought cattle to the cities. Then cattle has been king, because beef tastes a lot better than pork, in my opinion. But probably in the opinion of a lot of people. They vote with their dollars. They're buying a lot more beef than pork. Okay. Come forward to a new technology. This is not going to happen overnight. Think of the almond milk disrupting the dairy industry. It didn't happen in a year or 2 years or 5 years or 10 years. This is a 25-year process. If you're in the ranching business, you need to be aware of it. But there's no imminent doom. It will affect beef prices.
It's going to be, I tell you what, where it'll affect the beef the most, and that is the consumer mass-produced beef that where you have a unit and you have calves and you raise
right.
them to a certain age and then you sell them off to the feedlot.
Yeah, and then the feedlot just packs them in as tight as they can. That and stuff is going to be affected.
The folks that are going for the grass-fed beef and they're selling it by the ounce
yeah.
and are probably going to continue to do
right.
well, because they're going to be some hardcore people.
And that's really the 100 years from now, there will still be ranchers doing cattle. But it's likely that they are going to be a niche thing, not the many, many hundreds of millions of acres that are devoted to cattle now.
It's very much like the change occurred in the 1830s, very similar change occurred. But you saw the biggest expansion in the cattle industry following the Civil War, when the big cattle drives were going on and
right.
they were selling mass quantities of cattle. The cattle industry has been shrinking in some versus the rest of the economy ever since.
Yeah, as far as employment goes, as far as a lot of things go.
But there's one of the big issues that we're warning about is there's mass changes in the economy that are about to take place and will largely take place over the next decade. And it's a really good idea to be aware of that. If you've been in the cattle industry very long and you anywhere west of where we are here in Temple, you went through the drought and you realize it's a boom and bust situation. And there were periods of time when during the drought, particularly where you were paying to raise cattle, you weren't being paid to raise cattle, you were paying to raise cattle. And the cattle raising has become more and more and more efficient with the feedlots. And the real price of beef has been falling for a long time.
And the feedlots also have some health detriments there. So the lowest cost beef is the target for this new kind of meat. They're aiming at replacing the low cost stuff there, which will push a lot of the ranchers, if they haven't already started moving that direction, towards grass fed type organic stuff. And I think that may forever have a niche. There will be people that say, I would rather have real meat, even if this meat is just as real as that meat. There's something about it that will cause people to want it. So keep that in mind as well. It's just going to be a much smaller thing. More and more and more people. I mean, if you ask someone where their meat came from and start talking about the cow, the vast majority of people are disgusted by that. They just ignore it. Why they're disgusted by it is beyond me, because where do they think the meat that they're eating comes from?
The mass-produced beef that we have in the United States today will largely be replaced by vegetable-based beef. Now,
future meat is using a combination of vegetable and actual meat that it's grown from stem cells.
But the point is, when I say actual meat coming from an actual animal, there's still, just like today, there is a very, very profitable market, if you can get into it, for Kobe beef.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And there's a very profitable market for grass-fed beef.
That's the most profitable part of the beef market.
That will not go away. And anybody that thinks that they can just do what they've always been doing and get the same results are probably going to be disappointed in the beef market.
As we were in the pickup truck on the way to the studio this morning, we talked about something. We were kind of joking about it. And the last statement on a specific conversation was there's been more technological advancements between the Connecticut Yankee and now than King Arthur's Court and the Connecticut Yankee when it was written by Mark Twain. So think about that for a second. It was written kind of like we are so much better than they were in King Arthur's day. We would have to go back 500 or 600 years to show them all our great technology. We go back less than 50 years now and we get the same kind of shift. And it's speeding up. So it's going to be meat and it's going to be a lot of other things. One of the great, great things of this supply chain stretching off to China and so on has been the tremendous lack of expense in developing new kinds of stuff. You can just order parts that are relatively cheap. They arrive relatively quickly. You put them together and you have the thing that you designed. You can design it in a computer and see if it works before you actually build it. And then you can actually build it without being a major company and devoting a lot of custom machinist hours and custom electronics specialist hours to doing it. It's just there. And in the future, we'll have that facility relatively easy to get to in local spaces. Like in your house, you will hit a button and print out your electronics. And in your house, you will hit a button and print out your food. It's just not going to be right away.
You know, I just kind of have a feeling it's going to go the other way.
That it's not going to get printed out?
It won't be printed out in your house. It'll be printed out locally, like at the store where you buy it.
It might be. It's quite possible.
If I had the choice, and it's just a matter of convenience. If I had the choice, for example, for to get a new flashlight.
Uh-huh.
Of printing out a flashlight in my house or hitting a one-day delivery from Amazon, I'd go for the one-day delivery from Amazon every time.
But the cost is the big factor here. If they can bring down the manufacturing price, I'll give you another item. Your clothes. So you have a shirt on. You are done with your shirt for the day. You take your shirt off and you drop it in your
trash
laundry. and the laundry takes your shirt and pulls it apart and makes you a brand new shirt of your design
now
out
that,
of the same stuff.
That is conceivable.
That's one of the things that I'm talking about, is
but
that the
but
long
term.
I
don't think I'd be manufacturing a shirt in my house.
You may not be. It may be that it will weave itself or print itself. That's not that far advanced. And it could be that there's still going to be stores that do it, but that's another middle person. That's another price increase. And, you know, right now it is not cost effective to 3D print everything that you make for everything that you do in your house. It's just not cost effective. That would be really expensive. But we're at the very baby steps of that technology. If they can bring that price down and have like a neighborhood printing facility that you hit your button and it gets printed there instead of delivered from Amazon somewhere across the galaxy, or the Amazon itself. Anyway, we got to play some commercials this hour.
We
haven't
do.
Done it. So we're going to do that, and we'll be back on
telephone
the
number
other side.
Remains in here, 254-773-1400, if today is the 12th of October, 2019.
Thank you very much, and we'll be back on the other side with more of The Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. If you're a subscriber to The Economist, it's worth reading the current issue. And if you're not, it might even be worth getting the current issue about the fact that there is a new economy that we're in. And it is we're beginning to see that the rules are changing. And it's a global economy. And we can't escape it no matter what we do. And it's a lot of the rules that we thought were pretty solid in the past aren't solid anymore. And the reason we think they're not, I mean, rules, they're just rules of economics. But things have changed. We've had a dramatic decrease in the cost of transportation. We've had a dramatic increase or decrease in the cost of automation. And that is going to accelerate. The caller a few minutes ago was talking about how it's going to affect the beef industry. The transportation industry and the beef industry, and for that matter, the swine industry, are going to have some of the biggest impacts, initial impacts. But then it's going to mushroom out from there, and it will go through our entire society, very much like the change we saw in the 1920s. We went into the 1920s with the majority of farming done by manual labor and animal labor, and we came out of the 1920s with very few animals left on the farm and relatively few workers left on the farm. And in the process, about 30% of America was out of a job. This is a reality that we're facing going forward, and it's one that it's hard to think beyond the – sometimes it's hard to think beyond the end of the week, and it's hard to think beyond the end of the year, but it's important to recognize, to look around and realize – that as wages have gone up a little bit, which is one of the reasons we're not seeing wages go up, we're not seeing inflation. As wages started to go up and the demand for workers started to be higher than the supply, McDonald's installed kiosks. And instead of there being gone into McDonald's, this is probably the most
that
obvious
came,
example.
That came directly from minimum wage hikes on the West Coast.
But you go into McDonald's today, instead of five people sitting behind registers taking orders, you might have one. You go into it's already there at the banks. You go into a bank or a branch bank, and you'll see lots and lots of places where tellers could be, and there'll be one teller there. Why? Because there's an automated teller machine.
I'll tell you a place that's really, really, really apparent. Pick up a phone and dial zero. If you have a landline, who's going to answer the call?
I don't know.
It's not going to be a person.
And when you call a company, you normally get a phone tree. You won't at the Personal Wealth Coach during the week. During business hours, you get a real live person who will really talk to you. We're really proud of that, but that means we're inefficient. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm the guy called about the beef earlier. Hey, I don't accept that. I don't accept that change, and I think that they're undermining the American people and their jobs, and I don't accept this all, you know, you can check yourself out so we don't have to buy, so we don't have to pay for a cashier.
Well, the people
are
doing
it. That Economist magazine, they don't put the author's name down.
Oh yeah, they do.
Articles.
Yeah, they do.
And I've seen where they don't.
Well, it all depends on whether it's a general article or whether it's a specific subject area. But sometimes they put it down. Traditionally, news media don't do that. Well, if you say you don't accept it, what grocery store do you use?
Well, we go to the only one that's around. We got to go to H-E-B or we got to go to Walmart.
Okay, if you go to H-E-B or you go to Walmart, look at the number of automated tellers that are there. You don't accept those as existing?
No, I didn't. I never accepted them. In fact, I saw this coming 10 years ago when they first started this stuff. So the stuff you guys are talking about, I was aware of it back then.
Yep.
And I told those folks, I said, you know what, I can go over there and check out, because they'll come to you and say, hey, you can come over here and check out, and this, you know, check yourself out. And it's like, no, I don't want to do that.
But I wouldn't
go to this person over here working for
sure.
me.
Sure.
And that's what we're saying, is that there will always be a niche for that. And that long term, right now, I don't want to go to those self-checkout things. There's too many problems with them. I have been through probably maybe 4 times where I didn't get some kind of error telling me to take the thing out of the bag or put the thing back in the bag or put my left foot on my right ear and stick my tongue out. I would much rather go to the person behind the cash register, but it's getting better.
But I don't get it at McDonald's. Matter of fact, I don't have to stand in line to go to the kiosk at McDonald's, whereas McDonald's in the past, I'd go into one during a busy period, and I'd have to stand in line behind 10 people and wait.
This is what I mean about it's not overnight. It takes place over a long period of time. It's not going to crush every shopping person's job. If they're standing behind a cash register, they probably have a pretty good future for the next decade or more.
It's kind of like what happens if you pay with a credit card or you pay with cash. People just don't carry enough cash to go buy gasoline because gasoline's expensive.
I'll go anywhere I can not to deal with an automated situation.
I'll go
to a mom and pop's.
When you buy gasoline at a gas station, do you go inside and pay the teller?
I do, cash.
Okay, you are an exceptional person.
And what that is, you are, and people like you, and I will be like you sometimes. We'll keep some form of what we have right now around, but if you go to any gas station and watch how many people are paying at the pump versus going inside. They used to have a lot more tellers, and if you look at the old, like, Racetrack and Bucky's and all of the gas pumps that they have. You know how many people inside they would have had to have all those people go inside and stand at the line. It's allowed Bucky's to exist because.
Well, fine. I mean, that's all good and well. But I also was aware of these skimmers like years ago.
Oh, yeah.
I seen it at that Walmart there in Copper's Cove. And I went up to the cashier. I said, hey, man, these guys over here are scanning your customers' cards when they're swiping their cards. Because it doesn't always have to be a skimmer. They got the right apps on their phone.
Yeah.
They can get that stuff. And I told the guy, and he's looking at me like a pig looking at a wristwatch, you know?
Yeah.
He don't have a clue what
right.
the heck I'm talking about. Because if you ain't tech savvy, you don't understand what's going on.
Yep, right.
And most of us are targeted and there's nothing we can do.
Okay, we're getting close to out of time. Just for the record, we buy grass-fed beef, and we pay extra for it.
I'm glad you do.
But that's the point. It's not inexpensive, and if you're living on low wages, you can't afford to buy hand-raised cattle meat.
Yeah. So they go with the cheaper route, and that's what I mean about the least expensive meat is the stuff that's going to be in direct competition.
That's what will disappear. And if you're in the custom-raising cattle business where you groom the cow and you feed them grass,
give them a massage every day,
you're going to do great.
Paint their hooves.
All right, we got to go.
What you said, but I think we need to stand behind our people and back off this tech. It, you know, just because you can do something don't mean it's a good idea.
Oh, I agree with you. Unfortunately, most people can't afford to do that. Thank you very much for calling. We appreciate your point of view.
And we're about out of time for this week. Thank you all for listening. If you're not listening, ha-ha, you can't hear me say you didn't get to hear the whole show. Ha! So there. And you didn't hear that part either.
This is a whole show?
It's less than a... It's
more than a half show. Anyway, yeah, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we are an investment management firm, wealth management for people, particularly with higher net worth. If you have enough money, you can live on it. You probably need to have a professional managing it who's a fiduciary fee-only organization like ours. And it is, our telephone number is 254-947-1111. That's locally.
You can reach that same real live people during the week, not automated, but it's voicemail during the weekend. 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and there you can read our newsletter, listen to recordings of this program going back quite a few years.
And check to see if we were right in the past.
Yeah, contact us there. There's a contact form, or you can send us an email directly. We use them on the air, Jeff at tpwc.com. Or